Hearing with Marshall Cohen on 11 August 78.
One thing that occurred to me is, did you ever think about using these polarimetric techniques to non-solar effects, and if so, why didn't you do it?
I did to a small extent, but I never pushed the ideas very far. We had no large antenna, there was no real opportunity. Other people were doing those things anyway.
Okay. Now, about the Arecibo antenna, can you tell me when you first heard about it, and then what role radio astronomy played in the development?
I was very close with Bill Gordon. We talked a great deal about the sun, about propagation sometimes, and he got the idea of using Thomson backscattering as a means of measuring electron density, and calculating the size of the telescope, the size of a reflector that would be needed to get echoes using state-of-the-art electronics, say. And I think he gave a talk about it. It was either a formal lecture or else just lunch conversations, as it were. It turned out it was a very large telescope he was talking about, a very large dish. And it was immediate then. I mean, the immediate idea in my mind was that this then could be an extremely powerful radio telescope and could be used and could be used directly for planetary radar measurements. And I calculated made the first estimates of the return that you could get from planets. And this was all within the first few weeks, it seems to me.
But now, hold on, he was thinking of a fixed dish.
He was thinking of a fixed dish, that's right. But I, nonetheless, given the dish, what I did was try to calculate what you could see if you had this dish and this transmitter and this receiver, if you had the system that he was postulating that could see electrons in the ionosphere, could it see the planets? And the answer is yes, it could see the planets, but of course only if the planet was in the beam, which meant that it had to be, if it was a fixed dish, that the thing had to be in the tropics, and you'd see the planets for 5 minutes every 10 years, or whatever it turned out to be. And so the idea of a steerable dish came about. It was introduced very early on in the history of the project because of the potential interest in looking at the planets.
I see. That was the primary motivation to make it steerable.
That was the first, that's right. That's how the notion of being steerable got into it, and that was a very early notion. I think it was certainly within the first weeks of the original conception of the idea. The notion of using it for radio astronomy itself as a passive reflector was also there in a sense from the beginning, but not in terms of such specific applications, so that it wasn't anywhere near as strongly motivated force. John Cox and I spent quite a bit of time talking about the uses of a dish, this postulated dish, scientific applications,
yes, I know
of
that,
this
right.
thing. And John and I had a piece in that, and we discussed also the radar possibilities.
What did it look like would be most promising in the passive? Of course, I can check the report.
I'm trying to remember. I can't remember at the moment. I remember we tried to think a lot about stars. The notion of looking at flare stars was in the air at that time.
Well, Lovell had in fact discovered a couple.
I think that's right.
57, 58.
Right, and John Cox and I talked a lot about different stars and what would happen. In fact, there's been some use of Arecibo for flare stars, but not a heck of a lot. That was not a big application, it turned out. But of course, other things that we didn't know about have become a big application. Pulsars, for example.
Right.
Had we had the wit to think about pulsars, we would have thought immediately about that.
You had an upper frequency now of 600 megahertz that you were...
The first frequency was 430 megahertz. That was probably the first one that was thought about. Well, it was a radar... It was an assigned frequency. It's the kind of frequency you could get for powerful space radar. And we talked about that. I think 600 megahertz was one of the early radio astronomy frequencies, but that was not built into the design. The design of the reflector was for 400 some megahertz, and that worked pretty well at 600. It did not work at 21 centimeters. We tried very early on.
Oh, yes.
We had a primitive 21 centimeter receiver. It didn't work. The reflector was no good.
But the specs for the reflector didn't say it.
No, that was no surprise.
Okay.
It was no surprise, but we recognized the importance of the systems for studying hydrogen. But it was clearly not suitable for that. And of course, it was 15 years later or whatever before the thing was resurfaced, and then it began to become extremely powerful for hydrogen.
Last week, Bill Gordon told me about the getting it funded and this sort of thing, covered that pretty well. I was wondering, from your point of view, were there necessary compromises between the passive applications and the active ones? Or were you quite happy with the way, from the radio astronomy point of view, that the specifications went?
I'm trying to remember. I didn't get involved in the detailed design very much.
I see.
But I was certainly involved in discussions of all kinds. There was one unfortunate thing, I mean, nothing that had been designed in, but it did happen, of course, that the first feed that was built was bad. And it took us a lot of that first year just to find out what was wrong with it.
What was the fundamental?
Well, they were exciting higher order harmonics. It was a square feed. Perhaps you know what it was. It was slotted and square and 96 feet long. And the basic problem ended up being that the elementary little aperture pieces were not on the focus, but were a substantial fraction of the wavelength from the focus, as they had to be. And that excited circumferential modes. And so there were whole great areas of the aperture, ultimately, that were out of phase. It was Ron Bracewell who helped figure that out. In fact, there was this famous Bracewell committee that lasted for years.
I'm not sure I know about that committee.
The Bracewell committee.
Yes.
That was a committee laid on, I suppose, by the Air Force as a watchdog committee. It wasn't really a visiting committee in the NRAO sense. It was a committee. You better ask Bill Gordon or ask Bracewell. But from the very beginning, there was the Bracewell committee, and it had a number of other people. Membership circulated, but Ron Bracewell was the boss of it for a long time. Even while it was... Well, that committee certainly existed at the very beginning. I don't know whether it existed at the early parts of the construction or not, but it was an advisory committee. I don't know now whether it was a committee organized by the Air Force, who was paying for it, say, or whether it was organized by Cornell University.
But this was one of their first major problems, anyway.
Bracewell himself spent some time in Puerto Rico. I lived there for almost a year. And toward the thing, obviously, didn't work. I mean, at the very beginning of the thing, when it first came on, we discovered lots and lots of double sources, which turned out to be side lobes. And then we got to recognize what the beam shape really was, and had these enormous side lobes. Mm-hmm. Nobody understood the thing, and then it was only after we went to some horrendous exercise of basically measuring the primary the illumination right on the mesh. We built up a little sled and a wagon and so on.
Yes.
Big experiment that I was essentially in charge of, and we had recorders and we transmitted from above and ran. It might have been the other way. Might have had We had a transmitter in this little sled, and we slid it up and down and made lots of radio cuts across the mesh and recorded the signal. We had phase reference. And basically, we mapped the amplitude and phase over this mesh and did Fourier transforms and found out what the aperture distribution was. We recognized that there were these sections. There was had six-sided symmetry.
I see.
Pluses and minuses. There was whole great sections that didn't look right. And we stared at this a long while. It was Ron Bracewell who, in fact, did most of the detailed analysis on that. You could analyze that into appropriate cylindrical components and carry these back up to the feed. And then it was recognized that it sort of almost became obvious long after the fact. That feed had been designed by Alan Kay at TRG, and he was no slouch. He was a very highly respected antenna designer who knew a great deal. And I guess he is to be faulted for having designed a feed which didn't work by 3 or 4 dB. That is, the gain was off by 3 or 4 dB because a third of the aperture was out of phase.
Yeah.
That's approximately the way to look at it.
But of course,
he didn't know it in advance.
No line feed of this size had ever been built before.
No, nothing like that. Yeah. There had been some line feeds built, but they were thin line feeds. And this gets back to your original question. Had this been done only for radio astronomy, you wouldn't have tried to build a thing that was circularly polarized, which was needed for electron scatter. You would have built a thin one.
And then the
effective dipoles would have been very close to the axis. In fact, as soon as Bracewell made this breakthrough, we then began to think of what you could do to cure it. And we very soon then built some thin feeds. And the first one that was built was 600 megahertz. That worked very well.
I see. This would be what year now?
Well, I lived in Puerto Rico in 1962, most of 1962. And we built a traveling wave 600 megahertz feed toward the end of that year. In fact, I built one with a student in Giovanni Perona. We wrote a paper on that in the IEEE something or other, mm-hmm. I suppose. That worked pretty well. Since then, they've built line feeds. That was that was a short thing. That was a thing with dipoles, and it worked well, reasonably well. But by that time, we were beginning to understand the feed problem.
Right.
Since then, much more elaborate feeds have been built.
This thing was also very bad for the ionosphere, mainly because of the loss of gain.
That's right.
Not so much the side lobes.
They
probably didn't like those either.
Yeah, well, it was murder for the ionosphere or for radar, any radar, because it's a round trip situation.
Right.
You're off 6 dB or whatever it is on a round trip.
What, in fact, were the first decent, so to speak, radio passive observations that were done?
I think the first serious work that was done there, in my mind, was interplanetary scintillations. The beam had such a bad shape. Excuse me, are they running in there now? I'm supposed to be taking serious notes because I have
5 minutes.
Okay. The beam was so bad that you couldn't do. And the change of gain with zenith angle was also very bad because it had a lot of spillover, a vignetting.
Right.
So you couldn't make proper flux measurements, and it was just very difficult
to
do things.
Or it took a lot of while to calibrate it out. Anyway.
Calibration was
still
very,
have
very
that today, of course.
I guess they have that to some large extent still. Well, the higher frequency ones at least only illuminate a smaller section.
That's true. Not as severe, yeah.
It's not so severe for the first 10 or 15 degrees of motion or whatever. But anyway, those problems are just extremely severe. And the things that did work out well were those things which depended on rapid variations. And we did some lunar occultations, which were good. In fact, actually the very first ones of those I did with Kundu. We even, I think, wrote a paper on that. And Hazard came the following year and did a whole string of them, Hazard and Jauncey and others.
Mm-hmm.
But that was started before Hazard got there. But then he built up a very much larger program. But we got von Horner's algorithm from NRAO and modified it some and used it in our receiver. And then Cyril came from Australia and did his own trick. But then we got into interplanetary scintillations
with
a series of papers.
Getting a little bit past my
yeah, that was I wanted to ask, though,
once the feed problem got fixed, sort of what fraction of the dish time went to passive radio astronomy?
Probably about a half, I should say.
Well, that much, even in that early stage.
Yeah, but radio astronomy always, from the beginning, took more than its share, as it were, of time. The radar guys would take very small amounts of time. That is, planetary radar was an occasional, very intense operation, but it lasted only for 6 hours or whatever.
Yeah.
Or maybe they'd do a practice and they'd have to fire up the transmitter and all that, but it was basically a very short-term, but very intensive operation.
They
do a lot of computing. The ionosphere occasionally, they would take large blocks of time. Sometimes they do continuous 48-hour experiments, transmitting continuously and so on. And then all the rest was filled in various ways with radio astronomy. A lot of the stuff in that first couple of years turned out to be no good, simply because the side lobes were so bad. Ilya Kazez from Paris was there for a couple of years. He got very little science out of what he did all that time. He was looking at galaxies and lots of other things.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that a great deal of that simply was of very marginal accuracy.
One final question. You started off essentially as an electrical engineer, or half that and half physicist, in the early 50s. And then you became what we call a radio astronomer. What did you say that you did at a cocktail party, say, in 1957, if someone asked you?
In 1957,
when you were
in particular. Well, in 1957, I had been in the electrical engineering department for 3 years. I was a junior member of the EE faculty. I was in electrical engineering, but I was doing radio astronomy.
So you would say you were a radio astronomer then? Or?
Well, when I went to meeting of the AAS or ERSI or something, I'd say I was a radio astronomer. I don't remember what I said at Cornell. During that period, I stopped calling myself an electrical engineer and began calling myself an astronomer, because in 1963 or something like that, I forget when, I left electrical engineering totally and went into the astronomy department. That was a sort
at
of
Cornell.
At Cornell. I was an associate professor of electrical engineering, and then I became an associate professor of astronomy. I just switched departments.
So then it was
Easy. I didn't have
ambiguity.
That's right. That was an interesting switch, which isn't often done, but engineer isn't the right word, but my interest just got that way, and I talked to all the people, all the different chairmen and the deans and so on, and we just went ahead and wrote something down on a piece of paper, and I changed my office and my teaching changed. Well, it didn't even change that much, necessarily. The teaching changed. The teaching loads were less in astronomy than they were in engineering. I think that's true at every university. So that was one thing, but that wasn't what was so fundamental, though I suppose some people thought it was. What was more fundamental was the association. My interests were really in astronomy, mm-hmm. radio astronomy, and equipment, a lot of it, equipment and techniques, but also in astrophysics. And people that I really wanted to talk to and be with and eat lunch with and so on were always in some building that was a quarter of a mile away.
Up to that time, were you still the only radio astronomer at Cornell?
That's almost true. When Arecibo began getting substantial, there were people who were working at
right.
in Puerto Rico, of course. In the beginning, well, Arecibo brought in a lot more people. The solar work, prior to the Arecibo times, there was me and there was Ed Schiffmacher, who left somewhere in there and went up to the Bureau of Standards. There was an occasional person like Kenji Akabani, who was from Japan.
But basically, though, you were the
basically,
only staff
member. Certainly the only staff member interested in doing any real radio astronomy.
Okay, thank you very much.
That is the interview with Marshall Cohen on 11 August 78.